This is 90.9 WBUR with special coverage from Radio Boston. Good afternoon, I'm Anthony Brooks. And we're following breaking news as the U.S. Senate gets set to vote on the Supreme Court nomination of Brett Kavanaugh tomorrow. This morning, following the FBI's week-long investigation into allegations of sexual abuse, Kavanaugh's nomination cleared a major hurdle in the Senate, a procedural vote of 51-49 that moves the nomination to a final vote tomorrow. And here's where we stand right now. Arizona Senator Jeff Flake says he will vote yes to confirm Kavanaugh. He was one of the key Republican swing votes in this nomination battle. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, one of the other key Republican swing votes, says she will vote no. So this could come down to Republican Susan Collins of Maine, who's expected to announce her decision from the Senate floor any minute now. And we will bring you that live when that happens. Until then, I'm joined by our Friday Week in Review panelist, Tiziana Deering, professor and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. She's also a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board and a regular member of our Week in Review panel. Tiziana, happy Friday. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. He's here in his personal capacity, not representing the U.S. Naval War College. Tom, thanks so much for coming in.
Nice to be back. Thanks.
So, what a week. And as we wait for Susan Collins to begin her comments on the Senate floor, Tiziana, I'll start with you. There is a huge amount of pressure on this Republican senator's shoulders right now. What are you thinking about?
You know, having had some public leadership roles in my career previously, when you ask to be put in these leadership positions, you have said, I want the burden of responsibility of representing the American people. And sometimes that burden sits very, very heavily on your shoulders. Yeah. My heart goes out to her for the difficulty of this decision. And I also think this is a moment when we need so many people to remember that they asked to be the leaders in this position making these decisions now.
A little bit of information about Susan Collins of Maine. She was among the senators who voted yes to move this toward a procedural vote, which, Tom, might lead one to indicate, to suspect that she will vote yes tomorrow. But it doesn't necessarily mean that, so we're waiting to hear from her. But what are you thinking about? What is Susan Collins juggling in her mind before she makes this very difficult decision?
Well, it's I think the procedural vote is an important point to make. I used to work in the U.S. Senate a long time ago, and cloture is a vote that says we can end debate and go to a vote actually talk about the vote itself. So people who vote yes as Collins did can say, look, I let the process play out. I didn't vote to stymie a final vote. And so that's a pretty common thing. Now, it's pretty unusual for somebody to flip in between the cloture vote and a final confirmation vote. Now, if she does that, that'll be interesting. And really, the thing about Susan Collins, you couldn't script this. I mean, this kind of nominee with this sort of scandal and this kind of uproar with a female senator from a small, divided, kind of purplish, but really kind of red versus blue New England state. I mean, if you submitted this as a TV script, they tell you to rework it because it's a little too pat and neat.
Yeah, every time I picture her, I see a rock on one side and a hard place on the other, yeah. Right? And her sort of standing in between them.
Well, all morning we have been listening to some of the testimony by members of the Senate. I want to play a clip from Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, who was speaking on the Senate floor just a moment ago. He's among the Democrats, all the Democrats, obviously, voting. We're waiting to hear from Joe Manchin as well, but most Democrats will be voting no. And Senator Blumenthal focused on the demeanor of Judge Kavanaugh during that difficult hearing a week ago today, where he came across as very sharp, very angry, very partisan. So here's a little bit of what Richard Blumenthal said just a few moments ago.
What cannot be denied is that picture of Judge Kavanaugh before our committee, which indicated profoundly a lack of temperament and trustworthiness.
Tom Nichols, what's your view on this? How badly did Judge Kavanaugh undermine his credibility among a number of people with that performance a week ago?
I think it was disastrous. And, you know, speaking personally, I'm a kind of moderate New England conservative of the old school. When Kavanaugh's name first popped up, I said, well, that's about what you'd expect. I mean, this could have been a Jeb Bush or Rubio appointee or a Scott Walker appointee. To me, that outburst in front of the Senate was disqualifying in and of itself. He went down the rat hole of conspiracies. He pointed at the Democrat in a way that even Clarence Thomas, Tiziana and I were talking about this earlier, even Clarence Thomas didn't go partisan. He went angry, but he didn't single out the party.
So that was the distinction here, not just that he was angry, but that he was red hot partisan.
Right, that he was partisan, that he was, I think, doing damage to the institutions of government by going forward with these conspiracy theories. And I think, you know, some of my former comrades on the right are saying, well, you can't disqualify the guy because he lost his temper over being smeared in one hearing. And my answer is, this is why we have hearings. It's not a longevity promotion. If hearings don't matter and how the nominee conducts him or herself in a hearing doesn't matter, then just do away with hearings and just promote people based on length of service. We don't do it that way. We have hearings for a reason. And I think Kavanaugh completely flamed out in his.
Hmm. What did you see last week, Tiziana, with that performance by Kavanaugh?
I appreciate what Tom said, and I'll add to it, because disqualifying was actually the term that came up for me as well. And I'll go back to my original point. We are talking about him saying, I better than anyone else deserve to hold the role that one of only 9 people on the planet will hold, to be a steward of other people's needs and interests.
Tiziana, I'm going to interrupt because our understanding is we are going to Senator Susan Collins right now of Maine live on the Senate floor.
The Sergeant at Arms will restore order in the gallery. Sergeant.
So Susan Collins is on the Senate floor right now, and she's about to announce her decision on the Kavanaugh nomination. The sergeant at arms, we understand, is trying to restore order. You're hearing some protesters in the background there. We're going to go back live to the Senate. Here we go.
Expressions of approval or disapproval are not permitted in the Senate galleries. The senator for Maine.
Mr. President, the 5 previous times that I've come to the floor to explain my vote on the nomination of a justice to the United States Supreme Court, I have begun my floor remarks explaining my decision with a recognition of the solemn nature and the importance of the occasion. But today, we have come to the conclusion of a confirmation process that has become so dysfunctional, it looks more like a caricature of a gutter-level political campaign than a solemn occasion. The president nominated Brett Kavanaugh on July 9th. Within moments of that announcement, special interest groups raced to be the first to oppose him, including one organization that didn't even bother to fill in the judge's name on its pre-written press release. They simply wrote that they opposed Donald Trump's nomination of XX to the Supreme Court of the United States. A number of senators joined the race to announce their opposition, but they were beaten to the punch by one of our colleagues who actually announced opposition before the nominee's identity was even known. Since that time, we have seen special interest groups whip their followers into a frenzy by spreading misrepresentations and outright falsehoods about Judge Kavanaugh's judicial record. Over-the-top rhetoric and distortions of his record and testimony at his first hearing produced short-lived headlines, which, although debunked hours later, continued to live on and be spread through social media. Interest groups have also spent an unprecedented amount of dark money opposing this nomination. Our Supreme Court confirmation process has been in steady decline for more than 30 years. One can only hope that the Kavanaugh nomination is where the process has finally hit rock bottom. Against this backdrop, it is up to each individual senator to decide what the Constitution's advice and consent duty means. Informed by Alexander Hamilton's Federalist 76, I have interpreted this to mean that the president has broad discretion to consider a nominee's philosophy, whereas my duty as a senator is to focus on the nominee's qualifications as long as that nominee's philosophy is within the mainstream of judicial thought. I have always opposed litmus tests for judicial nominees with respect to their personal views or politics, but I fully expect them to be able to put aside any and all personal preferences in deciding the cases that come before them. I've never considered the president's identity or party when evaluating Supreme Court nominations. As a result, I voted in favor of Justices Roberts and Alito, who were nominated by President Bush, Justices Sotomayor and Kagan, who were nominated by President Obama, and Justice Gorsuch, who was nominated by President Trump. So I began my evaluation of Judge Kavanaugh's nomination by reviewing his 12-year record on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, including his more than 300 opinions and his many speeches and law review articles. 19 attorneys, including lawyers from the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service, briefed me many times each week and assisted me in evaluating the judge's extensive record. I met with Judge Kavanaugh for more than 2 hours in my office. I listened carefully to the testimony at the committee hearings. I spoke with people who knew him personally, such as Condoleezza Rice and many others. And I talked with Judge Kavanaugh a second time by phone for another hour to ask him very specific additional questions. I also have met with thousands of my constituents, both advocates and many opponents, regarding Judge Kavanaugh. One concern that I frequently heard was that the judge would be likely to eliminate the Affordable Care Act's vital protections for people with pre-existing conditions. I disagree with this contention. In a dissent in Seven Sky v. Holder, Judge Kavanaugh rejected a challenge to the ACA on narrow procedural grounds, preserving the law in full. Many experts have said that his dissent informed Justice Roberts' opinion upholding the ACA at the Supreme Court. Furthermore, Judge Kavanaugh's approach toward the doctrine of severability is narrow. When a part of a statute is challenged on constitutional grounds, he has argued for severing the invalid clause as surgically as possible while allowing the overall law to remain intact. This was his approach in his dissent in a case that involved a challenge to the structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. In his dissent, Judge Kavanaugh argued for, quote, severing any problematic portions while leaving the remainder intact, end quote. Given the current challenges to the ACA, proponents, including myself, of protections for people with pre-existing conditions should want a justice who would take just this kind of approach. Another assertion that I've heard often is that Judge Kavanaugh cannot be trusted if a case involving alleged wrongdoing by the president were to come before the court. The basis for this argument seems to be twofold. First, Judge Kavanaugh has written that he believes that Congress should enact legislation to protect presidents from criminal prosecution or civil liability while in office. Mr. President, I believe opponents miss the mark on this issue. The fact that Judge Kavanaugh offered this legislative proposal suggests that he believes that the president does not have such protection currently. Second, there are some who argue that given the current special counsel investigation, President Trump should not even be allowed to nominate a justice. That argument ignores our recent history. President Clinton, in 1993, nominated Justice Ginsburg after the Whitewater investigation was already underway, and she was confirmed 96-3. The next year, just 3 months after independent counsel Robert Fisk was named to lead the Whitewater investigation, President Clinton nominated Justice Breyer. He was confirmed 87-9. Supreme Court justices have not hesitated to rule against the presidents who have nominated them. Perhaps most notably in the United States versus Nixon, three Nixon appointees who heard the case joined the unanimous opinion against him. Judge Kavanaugh has been unequivocal in his belief that no president is above the law. He has stated that Marbury versus Madison, Youngstown Steel versus Sawyer, and the United States versus Nixon are three of the four greatest Supreme Court cases in history. What do they have in common? Each of them is a case where Congress served as a check on presidential power. And I would note that the fourth case that Judge Kavanaugh has pointed to as the greatest in history was Brown versus the Board of Education. One Kavanaugh decision illustrates the point about the check on presidential power directly. He wrote the opinion in Hamdan versus the United States, a case that challenges the Bush administration's military commission prosecution of an associate of Osama bin Laden. This conviction was very important to the Bush administration, but Judge Kavanaugh, who had been appointed to the D.C. Circuit by President Bush and had worked in President Bush's White House, ruled that the conviction was unlawful. As he explained during the hearing, quote, "We don't make decisions based on who people are, or their policy preferences, or the moment. We base decisions on the law," end quote. Others I've met with have expressed concerns that Justice Kennedy's retirement threatens the right of same-sex couples to marry. Yet Judge Kavanaugh described the Obergefell decision, which legalized same-gender marriages, as an important landmark precedent. He also cited Justice Kennedy's recent masterpiece cake shop opinion for the court's majority, stating that, quote, the days of treating gay and lesbian Americans or gay and lesbian couples as second-class citizens who are inferior in dignity and worth are over in the Supreme Court, end quote. Others have suggested that the judge holds extreme views on birth control. In one case, Judge Kavanaugh incurred the disfavor of both sides of the political spectrum for seeking to ensure the availability of contraceptive services for women while minimizing the involvement of employers with religious objections. Although his critics frequently overlooked this point, Judge Kavanaugh's dissent rejected arguments that the government did not have a compelling interest in facilitating access to contraception. In fact, he wrote that the Supreme Court precedent strongly suggested that there was a compelling interest in facilitating access to birth control. There has also been considerable focus on the future of abortion rights based on the concern that Judge Kavanaugh would seek to overturn Roe v. Wade. Protecting this right is important to me. To my knowledge, Judge Kavanaugh is the first Supreme Court nominee to express the view that precedent is not merely a practice and tradition, but rooted in Article 3 of our Constitution itself. He believes that precedent is not just a judicial policy, it is constitutionally dictated to pay attention and pay heed to rules of precedent. In other words, precedent isn't a goal or an aspiration. It is a constitutional tenet that has to be followed except in the most extraordinary circumstances. The judge further explained that precedent provides stability, predictability, reliance, and fairness. There are, of course, rare and extraordinary times where the Supreme Court would rightly overturn a precedent. The most famous example was when the Supreme Court in Brown versus the Board of Education overruled Plessy versus Ferguson, correcting a grievously wrong decision, to use the judge's term, allowing racial inequality. But someone who believes that the importance of precedent has been rooted in the Constitution would follow long-established precedent, except in those rare circumstances where a decision is grievously wrong or deeply inconsistent with the law. Those are Judge Kavanaugh's phrases. As the judge asserted to me, a long-established precedent is not something to be trimmed, narrowed, discarded, or overlooked. Its roots in the Constitution give the concept of stare decisis greater weight, such that the precedent can't be trimmed or narrowed simply because a judge might want to on a whim. In short, his views on honoring precedent would preclude attempts to do by stealth that which one has committed not to do overtly. Noting that Roe v. Wade was decided 45 years ago and reaffirmed 19 years later in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, I asked Judge Kavanaugh whether the passage of time is relevant to following precedent. He said decisions become part of our legal framework with the passage of time, and that honoring precedent is essential to maintaining public confidence. Our discussion then turned to the right of privacy, on which the Supreme Court relied in Griswold versus Connecticut, a case that struck down a law banning the use and sale of contraceptives. Griswold established the legal foundation that led to Roe 8 years later. In describing Griswold as settled law, Judge Kavanaugh observed that it was the correct application of two famous cases from the 1920s, Meyer and Pierce, that are not seriously challenged by anyone today. Finally, in his testimony, he noted repeatedly that Roe had been upheld by Planned Parenthood versus Casey, describing it as precedent on precedent. When I asked him, would it be sufficient to overturn a long-established precedent if five current justices believed that it was wrongly decided? He emphatically said no. Opponents frequently cite then-candidate Donald Trump's campaign pledge to nominate only judges who would overturn Roe. The Republican platform for all presidential campaigns has included this pledge since at least 1980. During this time, Republican presidents have appointed Justices O'Connor, Souter, and Kennedy to the Supreme Court. These are the very three justices, Republican president-appointed justices, who authored the Casey decision which reaffirmed Roe. Furthermore, pro-choice groups vigorously opposed each of these justices' nominations. Incredibly, they even circulated buttons with the slogan, "Stop Souter or Women Will Die." Just 2 years later, Justice Souter co-authored the Casey opinion, reaffirming a woman's right to choose. Suffice it to say, prominent advocacy organizations have been wrong. These same interest groups have speculated that Judge Kavanaugh was selected to do the bidding of conservative ideologues, despite his record of judicial independence. I asked the judge point blank whether he had made any commitments or pledges to anyone at the White House, to the Federalist Society, to any outside group on how he would decide cases. He unequivocally assured me that he had not. Judge Kavanaugh has received rave reviews for his 12-year track record as a judge, including for his judicial temperament. The American Bar Association gave him its highest possible rating. Its Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary conducted an extraordinarily thorough assessment, soliciting input from almost 500 people, including his judicial colleagues. The ABA concluded that his integrity, judicial temperament, and professional competence met the highest standards. Lisa Blatt, who has argued more cases before the Supreme Court than any other woman in history, testified, quote, "By any objective measure, Judge Kavanaugh is clearly qualified to serve on the Supreme Court. His opinions are invariably thoughtful and fair." Ms. Blatt, who clerked for and is an ardent admirer of Justice Ginsburg, and who is, in her own words, an unapologetic defender of a woman's right to choose, says that Judge Kavanaugh fits within the mainstream of legal thought. She also observed that Judge Kavanaugh is remarkably committed to promoting women in the legal profession. That Judge Kavanaugh is more of a centrist than some of his critics maintain is reflected in the fact that he and Chief Judge Merrick Garland voted the same way in 93% of the cases that they heard together. Indeed, Chief Judge Garland joined in more than 96% of the majority opinions authored by Judge Kavanaugh, dissenting only once. Despite all this, after weeks of reviewing Judge Kavanaugh's record and listening to 32 hours of his testimony, the Senate's advice and consent role was thrown into a tailspin following the allegations of sexual assault by Professor Christine Blasey Ford. The confirmation process now involves evaluating whether or not Judge Kavanaugh committed sexual assault and lied about it to the Judiciary Committee. Some argue that because this is a lifetime appointment to our highest court, the public interest requires that doubts be resolved against the nominee. Others see the public interest as embodied in our long-established tradition of affording to those accused of misconduct a presumption of innocence. In cases in which the facts are unclear, they would argue that the question should be resolved in favor of the nominee. Mr. President, I understand both viewpoints. This debate is complicated further by the fact that the Senate confirmation process is not a trial. But certain fundamental legal principles about due process, the presumption of innocence, and fairness do bear on my thinking, and I cannot abandon them. In evaluating any given claim of misconduct, we will be ill-served in the long run if we abandon the presumption of innocence and fairness, tempting though it may be. We must always remember that it is when passions are most inflamed that fairness is most in jeopardy. The presumption of innocence is relevant to the advice and consent function when an accusation departs from a nominee's otherwise exemplary record. I worry that departing from this presumption could lead to a lack of public faith in the judiciary and would be hugely damaging to the confirmation process moving forward. Some of the allegations levied against Judge Kavanaugh illustrate why the presumption of innocence is so important. I am thinking in particular not of the allegations raised by Professor Ford, but of the allegation that when he was a teenager, Judge Kavanaugh drugged multiple girls and used their weakened state to facilitate gang rape. This outlandish allegation was put forth without any credible supporting evidence and simply parroted public statements of others. That such an allegation can find its way into the Supreme Court confirmation process is a stark reminder about why the presumption of innocence is so ingrained in our American consciousness. Mr. President, I listened carefully to Christine Blasey Ford's testimony before the Judiciary Committee. I found her testimony to be sincere, painful, and compelling. I believe that she is a survivor of a sexual assault and that this trauma has upended her life. Nevertheless, the four witnesses she named could not corroborate any of the events of that evening gathering where she says the assault occurred. None of the individuals Professor Ford says were at the party has any recollection at all of that night. Judge Kavanaugh forcefully denied the allegations under penalty of perjury. Mark Judge denied under penalty of felony that he had witnessed an assault. P.J. Smith, another person allegedly at the party, denied that he was there under penalty of felony. Professor Ford's lifelong friend, Leland Kaiser, indicated that under penalty of felony, she does not remember that party. And Ms. Kaiser went further. She indicated that not only does she not remember a night like that, but also that she does not even know Brett Kavanaugh. In addition to the lack of corroborating evidence, we also learned some facts that raise more questions. For instance, since these allegations have become public, Professor Ford testified that not a single person has contacted her to say, "I was at the party that night." Furthermore, the professor testified that although she does not remember how she got home that evening, she knew that because of the distance, she would have needed a ride. Yet not a single person has come forward to say that they were the one who drove her home or were in the car with her that night. And Professor Ford also indicated that even though she left that small gathering of six or so people abruptly and without saying goodbye and distraught, none of them called her the next day or ever to ask why she left. Is she okay? Not even her closest friend, Ms. Kaiser. Mr. President, the Constitution does not provide guidance on how we are supposed to evaluate these competing claims. It leaves that decision up to each senator. This is not a criminal trial, and I do not believe that the claims such as these need to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Nevertheless, fairness would dictate that the claims at least should meet a threshold of more likely than not as our standard. The facts presented do not mean that Professor Ford was not sexually assaulted that night or at some other time, but they do lead me to conclude that the allegations failed to meet the more likely than not standard. Therefore, I do not believe that these charges can fairly prevent Judge Kavanaugh from serving on the court. Let me emphasize that my approach to this question should not be misconstrued as suggesting that unwanted sexual contact of any nature is not a serious problem in this country. To the contrary, if any good at all has come from this ugly confirmation process, it has been to create an awareness that we have underestimated the pervasiveness of this terrible problem. I have been alarmed and disturbed, however, by some who have suggested that unless Judge Kavanaugh's nomination is rejected, the Senate is somehow condoning sexual assault. Nothing could be further from the truth. Every person, man or woman, who makes a charge of sexual assault deserves to be heard and treated with respect. The Me Too movement is real. It matters. It is needed. And it is long overdue. We know that rape and sexual assault are less likely to be reported to the police than other forms of assault. On average, an estimated 211,000 rapes and sexual assaults go unreported every year. We must listen to survivors, and every day we must seek to stop the criminal behavior that has hurt so many. We owe this to ourselves, our children, and generations to come. Since the hearing, I have listened to many survivors of sexual assault. Many were total strangers who told me their heart-wrenching stories for the first time in their lives. Some were friends that I had known for decades, yet with the exception of one woman who had confided in me years ago, I had no idea that they had been the victims of sexual attacks. I am grateful for their courage and their willingness to come forward, and I hope that in heightening public awareness, they have also lightened the burden that they have been quietly bearing for so many years. To them, I pledge to do all that I can to ensure that their daughters and granddaughters never share their experiences. Over the past few weeks, I have been emphatic that the Senate has an obligation to investigate and evaluate the serious allegations of sexual assault. I called for and supported the additional hearing to hear from both Professor Ford and Judge Kavanaugh. I also pushed for and supported the FBI's supplemental background investigation. This was the right thing to do. Christine Ford never sought the spotlight. She indicated that she was terrified to appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and she has shunned attention since then. She seemed completely unaware of Chairman Grassley's offer to allow her to testify confidentially in California. Watching her, Mr. President, I could not help but feel that some people who wanted to engineer the defeat of this nomination cared little, if at all, for her well-being. Professor Ford testified that a very limited number of people had access to her letter. Yet that letter found its way into the public domain. She testified that she never gave permission for that very private letter to be released. And yet, here we are. We are in the middle of a fight that she never sought, arguing about claims that she wanted to raise confidentially. Now, one theory I've heard espoused repeatedly is that our colleague, Senator Feinstein, leaked Professor Ford's letter at the 11th hour to derail this process. I want to state this very clearly. I know Senator Dianne Feinstein extremely well, and I believe that she would never do that. I knew that to be the case before she even stated it at the hearing. She is a person of integrity, and I stand by her. I have also heard some argue that the chairman of the committee somehow treated Professor Ford unfairly. Nothing could be further from the truth. Chairman Grassley, along with his excellent staff, treated Professor Ford with compassion and respect throughout the entire process. And that is the way the senator from Iowa has conducted himself throughout a lifetime dedicated to public service. But the fact remains, Mr. President, someone leaked this letter against Professor Ford's express wishes. I suspect, regrettably, that we will never know for certain who did it. To that leaker, who I hope is listening now, let me say that what you did was unconscionable. You have taken a survivor who was not only entitled to your respect, but who also trusted you to protect her. And you have sacrificed her well-being in a misguided attempt to win whatever political crusade you think you are fighting. My only hope is that your callous act has turned this process into such a dysfunctional circus that it will cause the Senate, and indeed all Americans, to reconsider how we evaluate Supreme Court nominees. If that happens, then the appalling lack of compassion you afforded Professor Ford will at least have some unintended positive consequences. Mr. President, the politically charged atmosphere surrounding this nomination has reached a fever pitch even before these allegations were known, and it has been challenging even then to separate fact from fiction. We live in a time of such great disunity as the bitter fight over this nomination both in the Senate and among the public clearly demonstrates. It is not merely a case of differing groups having different opinions. It is a case of people bearing extreme ill will toward those who disagree with them. In our intense focus on our differences, we have forgotten the common values that bind us together as Americans. When some of our best minds are seeking to develop even more sophisticated algorithms designed to link us to websites that only reinforce and cater to our views, we can only expect our differences to intensify. This would have alarmed the drafters of our Constitution, who were acutely aware that different values and interests could prevent Americans from becoming and remaining a single people. Indeed, of the six objectives they invoked in the preamble to the Constitution, the one that they put first was the formation of a more perfect union. Their vision of a more perfect union does not exist today. And if anything, we appear to be moving farther away from it. It is particularly worrisome that the Supreme Court, the institution that most Americans see as the principal guardian of our shared constitutional heritage, is viewed as part of the problem through a political lens. Mr. President, we've heard a lot of charges and countercharges about Judge Kavanaugh. But as those who have known him best have attested, he has been an exemplary public servant, judge, teacher, coach, husband, and father. Despite the turbulent, bitter fights surrounding his nomination, my fervent hope is that Brett Kavanaugh will work to lessen the divisions in the Supreme Court so that we have far fewer 5-4 decisions, and so that public confidence in our judiciary and our highest court is restored. Mr. President, I will vote to confirm Judge Kavanaugh. Thank you, Mr. President.
This is 90.9 WBUR with special coverage from Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Good afternoon. And we have been listening to Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine speaking on the floor of the U.S. Senate. She announced that she will vote in favor of Judge Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the High Court. The full Senate will vote tomorrow. And with Collins' support of Kavanaugh, he will become the next Associate Justice to the U.S. Supreme Court, barring any other unforeseen events. But as it stands right now, the Republicans have the votes they need. Collins said that Brett Kavanaugh has been an exemplary public servant, judge, teacher, coach, and father. And despite the bitter fight, she said that she will be voting for Brett Kavanaugh. Here in the studio with me, Tiziana Dearing and Tom Nichols. I'll start with you, Tiziana. A long speech from Senator Collins. What did you think? What did you hear?
Well, I was going to say I'm nearly speechless, which is shocking since I had 40 minutes to think about what to say. I'm heartbroken about this. And I'll be honest with you. It has nothing to do with the decision she made that she expressed in the last 3 seconds, but clearly knew for a while. I thought what we would wind up discussing after hearing from her was her decision. But instead, this speech was so far out of step with the moment and what people needed to hear and how we needed to focus. I'm honestly taken aback by what happened in the moment and the way the senator chose to approach communicating her vote.
And Tom, let me come to you. Tell me what you heard.
That was a speech by an institutionalist. That is somebody who values her party and the institution of the Senate over everything else. I mean, the fact that in the middle of this, to me, my personal view on this is that it was a breathtakingly cynical speech. A half-hour windup of seventh-grade social studies, Marbury v. Madison stuff to get to, look, I didn't believe the accusations. I don't think we should do things this way. I think it would have been easier to respect that speech if she just started that way. But it was, you know, in the middle of it, to take time out to say, and whoever besmirched the honor of the Senate here, you know, you're going to pay because the Senate, and it really is the sign of somebody who, you know, has lived her life in the Senate. And the Senate is the most important institution to her. And the Republican Party is the most important institution within that institution to her. So that's what you really heard was a ringing defense, not of a Supreme Court justice or of a legal principle. You heard a defense of the prerogatives of the Senate and the Republican Party.
Go ahead, Tiziana.
Well, and I think it wasn't helpful to the moment. I mean, we are in a moment. Listen, however she voted, she was going to vote one way or the other. And Kavanaugh was going to get confirmed one way or the other. But the damage has already been done, however these next 24 hours were going to play out. I think what I was hungry for in this moment was the first of hopefully many people to step forward and say, I got to start creating a path forward now for America. And to have a sort of a clearly pre-written blow-by-blow defense of a particular position that begins with old jurisprudence and gets to
the separability clause.
The pain of the Me Too moment 30 minutes in just you know, it just feels like the wrong step to take this moment.
It really is striking that she didn't get to the allegations against Judge Brett Kavanaugh for a good 20, 25 minutes into the speech. But let's talk a little bit about that, because she spoke of the allegations that Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted Christine Blasey Ford when they were in high school. She said there was sufficient doubt about the allegations, even as she said that she's not doubting necessarily that Dr. Ford might have been assaulted, but she said there is sufficient doubt that it was Judge Kavanaugh. Therefore, I do not believe that these charges can fairly prevent him from serving on the court. She talked about certain legal principles, believing in certain legal principles, among the presumption of innocence and fairness. And she said, I cannot abandon them. Tom Nichols, was that, I mean, to what extent? I mean, hearing Tiziana talk, it's like she didn't really address this issue in a full and complete way, leaving it so late in the speech as she did.
Well, we shouldn't let something slide that Tiziana pointed out, which is this, what was really stunning about this speech is it was clearly written days ago. This, we had this false drama of at 3 o'clock, you know, like Lisa Murkowski came out and said, look, I decided this on the fly. There was her statement, I think, was pretty heartfelt. This was a lot of kind of blowsy setup with a lot of fake drama around it to announce something that it sounds from the speech like she decided weeks ago and then stapled on, you know, a page at the end about, oh, and by the way, I don't believe any of this. And that, let me just point out again what I think is always an error the Democrats have made. The Democrats concentrated on charges that were very difficult to prove and left aside a raft of questions, starting with the judge's finances and right up until this week about temperament. I think that there was a much stronger case to be made. Look, I'm still agnostic. I don't, you know, we before the show we were talking, I said, I still don't know what happened between two minors in a house in the 1980s in Maryland. What I am sure of is what I saw in a hearing a week ago, and that should have been the center of this debate. But by focusing on this, Senator Collins said, here, I'm going to take some of the I'm going to take the Swetnick charges, for example, and I'm going to start with those and say, because these crazy charges, I just can't believe them. Therefore, I'm going to leave aside all that other stuff and he should be on the court. It was a huge strategic error by the Democrats, and the Republicans walked right through it.
Strategic error in the sense last Friday, insisting on an FBI investigation and not, for example, going after Kavanaugh's temperament and his performance on the committee. Is that what you mean?
Yes. And I think that that Democrats could have done both. They could have said, look, we agree with Senator Flake. This needs to be looked at. But we also need to now consider, I mean, the White House fenced this investigation off very neatly. You can only ask about a question that the FBI basically could not answer.
A lot more. Tiziana, we only have seconds left. I want to give the final word to you. Final thought.
Yeah, I guess if I were going to say anything else, I feel like we could set aside the determinations she made about Christine Blasey Ford's testimony and still not feel like this was a moment that respected, understood, or responded to the Me Too movement.
All right. Well, a lot more coming up on this story, on All Things Considered, in just a few minutes. You've been listening to special coverage. This is 90.9 WBUR Radio Boston. Have a great weekend. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.